From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What's happening to America's police? Mark Furman brags about abusing his power. Police corruption scandals have surfaced in Philadelphia, New York, and New Orleans. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Bowden of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He co-authored a series about one rogue cop. The charges against this cop led to a massive FBI investigation of police corruption in Philadelphia. Jim Gallipo is a probation officer who works with gang members in South Central L.A. We'll ask him how the Furman tapes and police corruption scandals have affected the already tense relations between cops and gangs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. NATO warplanes continue to attack Bosnian Serb military targets. Russia says the continued raids are genocidal. The United States has rejected the Russian claim, saying the raids are on military targets like ammunition dumps and radio towers, and civilians are not targeted. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says it's up to the Bosnian Serbs to determine when the bombing will stop. State Department officials are saying the strong Russian statement seems to be aimed at Russian hardliners who are upset at the loss of Russian influence in world affairs. In New York, National Basketball Association players have voted down a proposal to decertify the union. Players voted overwhelmingly not to decertify the union. National Labor Relations Board officials who counted the vote say the outcome was 226 players voting to keep the union and 134 voting to decertify. The vote clears the way for player representatives to approve a new labor contract when they meet tomorrow in Chicago. Owners could approve it Monday in New York. The president of Amtrak says he thinks the nation's passenger rail service can be weaned from taxpayer operating subsidies shortly after the turn of the century, but there is a string attached. Craig Windham reports.
Amtrak is receiving $365 million in federal operating money this fiscal year. Because of that help and a 15% reduction in routes, the railroad is expected to finish the year in the black. Congress is considering cutting the amount of subsidy nearly in half for the next year. Amtrak President Thomas Down says he's confident the railroad can meet a goal of being subsidy-free in its operating budget by the year 2001 or 2002. But he says Amtrak will continue to need government money to buy new trains and to make station improvements. Downs is proposing that 0.5 cents of the current per-gallon gasoline tax be dedicated to Amtrak capital funding. That idea has already drawn opposition, though, from the Highway Users Federation. The group contends the money raised from motor fuel taxes should be spent only on roads. I'm Craig Windham in Washington.
Maryland authorities say a man estranged from his wife drove his family to a shopping mall parking lot outside of Baltimore yesterday and blew up the car. Corporal Kevin Novak is a spokesman for the Baltimore County Police Department.
We're confident that it was a murder-suicide sort of affair. The husband, Mark Allen Clark, 32 years old, who has an address in Cumberland, Maryland, was apparently distraught over a breakup in the family. I'm not sure at this point when that breakup occurred or what the circumstances were.
Police say they have no records of domestic violence in the family, but they're questioning neighbors. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 30 points at 4,735. Trading is active. This is NPR. The head of the Atlanta Olympic Games says athletes will be instructed about U.S. laws and will not get special treatment if they are accused of crimes while they are in the U.S. for the Games. From Peach State Public Radio, Bruce Dorton reports.
Olympics Chief Billy Payne issued a policy statement today after another official was quoted as saying organizers would encourage retailers not to press charges against athletes accused of shoplifting during the 96 Games. Earlier, the head of international relations for the Olympics, Charles Battle Jr., had said, in most cases, athletes accused of a crime probably would be sent home. Battle said officials did not want Atlanta becoming what he called a police state during the games. Organizers already have stepped in to help three foreign athletes charged with shoplifting during last month's pre-Olympic events. Officials helped get two Armenian wrestlers released from jail. The athletes returned to their home country without attending their quota hearing. Another retailer decided not to press charges against an Iranian athlete when Olympic officials intervened. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
Negotiators for Detroit papers have canceled this week's contract talks with striking unions. A spokesman says the papers have to focus on questions from the Justice Department that stemmed from a union complaint. The unions filed an antitrust petition last month questioning the legality of the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News publishing a combined paper. Both papers publish separately Monday through Friday and then combine weekend editions. But since the strike began July 13th, they've published jointly. Six unions are striking the papers over wages, work rules, and alleged unfair labor practices. Witnesses to a small plane crash in Virginia over the weekend say they heard engine problems on the craft just before it crashed into a house. All 11 people aboard and a man sitting on his back porch were killed. Investigators say the plane made a strange noise as it took off and never got above 1,000 feet. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. These are bad times for the image of American cops. We have corruption scandals in several major cities, including New York, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. And, of course, there are the Mark Furman tapes. How does a rogue cop manage to stay on the force? The story of one rogue cop in Philadelphia has been told in a three-part series that concluded today in the Philadelphia Inquirer by Mark Fazlola and my guest Mark Bowden. Back in the winter of 1991, an innocent Temple University student, Arthur Colbert, filed a complaint against Officer John Baird and his partner after they arrested him, beat him up, and illegally searched his apartment. That complaint opened an FBI review that led to a wider investigation of the Philadelphia police force, which is still underway. Officer Jack Baird is now waiting to be sentenced.
Arthur Colbert's complaint led to an internal investigation and got, ultimately, three police officers fired. The police department has argued since, and the mayor of the city, that, in fact, this case is an illustration of how effectively the department polices its own ranks. I think what we discovered when we looked at it very carefully is that that wasn't true, and that, in fact, the department is just notoriously poor at policing its own ranks, and the only reason Arthur Colbert got justice is because they beat him up about a week before the Rodney King videotape in Los Angeles provoked a kind of national outcry against police abuses, and the Attorney General instructed the FBI throughout the country to begin reviewing police brutality cases. So Arthur Colbert, it turns out, was the 23rd person to complain about Jack Baird to the Philadelphia Police Department, and he's the first person whose complaint was sustained and the first person whose complaint led to any police being disciplined.
I want to hear the story of Arthur Colbert and what happened to him. He is a Detroit social worker. He was a student at Temple University at the time that he was harassed by Philadelphia police. Where was he when he was stopped by Jack Baird and his partner?
Well, Arthur had a hot date in North Philadelphia with a woman he had met only once before. And he was off looking for her house in an area of North Philadelphia, which is not far from Temple University's campus, but which is a really bad neighborhood. I mean, it's a drug-infested, decaying, poor black neighborhood in North Philadelphia, which is very aggressively patrolled by the police department. He got out of his car to look for this woman's house, as it happens, in the exact block where these two police officers were looking for a man who fit his general description, driving a small blue car, which Arthur drove. And so they jumped to the conclusion that this fellow was the drug pusher that they were looking for, picked him up and locked him in a van, drove him to an abandoned house, beat him, and held a gun to his head, demanding that he admit that he was this drug dealer. Arthur was, of course, terrified and was convinced that they were actually going to kill him. Eventually, they took him back out in handcuffs, took him back to the police station, and let him sit there, and went out to his apartment, which isn't even in Philadelphia. They drove out to Cheltenham, which is in a suburban area over which they have no jurisdiction, let themselves into his apartment and searched it illegally, and came back, I think, with the conclusion that, in fact, this really was just an innocent Temple student, and then they let him go with a threat that if he ever showed up in the neighborhood again, that they would kill him.
And what did Colbert decide to do?
Well, he was shaken up, obviously, and very, very angry, and he went back to his apartment and called his girlfriend and had a long talk with her about what had happened. And then he called his father in Detroit. His father had been a policeman and firefighter at the airport out in Detroit, and his father just insisted that the right thing to do would be to file a complaint. Arthur didn't have any faith that filing a complaint would amount to anything, but he was so indignant that he felt, I'm going to do something. I'm going to keep telling people this story until something happens, and I don't want anyone to accuse me later of not having filed a formal complaint. So the very next morning, I think it was pretty courageous on his part, he went right back into the district where he'd been beaten and threatened the night before and walked in and filed a formal complaint.
Now, Baird, the officer, was fired shortly after this complaint was filed.
2 months later, right.
And then what happened? What was the next step?
The way the process works in Philadelphia is once a police officer is suspended with intent to fire, and then they can fire him within 30 days, they're allowed to appeal to an arbitration board, which has been complained about vigorously by the police department brass and by the city administration because it's unbelievably lenient. Nearly everyone who goes before the arbitration board gets his job back with full back pay. So Jack Baird filed his appeal. But what was different about this case was that because of the Rodney King beating and because of the interest that the federal authorities had taken in police corruption cases and police brutality, the FBI was observing this process and was actively investigating on their own.
Now, what was the FBI's strategy in investigating the Baird case?
Well, there's something called the Garrity Rule, which says that in order to indict a police officer for a crime like this, their testimony about what happened can't be coerced. They can't be threatened in any way to give a confession. So they had to let the process go forward in hopes that Jack Baird would take the witness stand under oath and lie about what had happened. And then if they could subsequently prove that he had lied, they could indict him for federal crimes, and at which they subsequently did. And they're able to use him to, get inside the Philadelphia Police Department and investigate abuses all over the city.
What are some of the lies Jack Baird told?
Well, where do you start? I mean, initially, Baird smartly, I think, realized that this internal affairs investigation within the police department was different than others, because in the 22 previous cases where there had been complaints filed against him, he had always freely answered questions from internal affairs, and at the end, no matter what the evidence, the case was always dismissed. In this case, he refused to answer any questions. And he instead waited until his appeal, whereupon he got on the stand. First, he hired a woman to come in and lie to back up his story that, in fact, Arthur Colbert was a drug pusher. He paid this woman's rent for her apartment for a year, gave her money, and got all of her, she was a prostitute, so he got all outstanding warrants against her expunged. And in return, she got on the stand and fluently lied about how this fellow, Arthur Colbert, was in fact a drug dealer named Hakim and how she had pointed them out to the police. And then Baird's sergeant got on the stand and lied to protect him. And then Baird himself got up there and told a story that very cleverly covered all of the facts that investigators had gathered against him with innocent explanations, with mitigating factors or whatever, so that ultimately the attorney, or it's not really attorney, the paralegal who was representing the city trying to keep Baird off of the force, concluded that he was going to lose the case because ultimately Baird had presented a pretty strong argument that all he had done was what a regular cop would do.
I want to say here, too, that you describe him as having represented himself during his testimony as a victim of the Rodney King story because, the department was getting politically correct after the Rodney King verdict, and that's why they fired Baird.
Right. His argument was that here this guy walks in off the street, he's really a drug dealer, but he's angry and he makes up a story about me, and he says that I held a gun to his head, and he says that I pushed him around, neither of which I did. This is Baird's story. And they're taking it real seriously now because of the Rodney King incident. They're out to get cops.
So Baird lies. Cops lie to defend him. Baird has bought off a prostitute who lies to defend him, too.
Mm-hmm.
Then the FBI intervenes. What does the FBI do?
Well, the counsel for the city was so appalled by the testimony of this prostitute when she came in. to him, he's handled hundreds and hundreds of these cases, and he can spot people who are obviously lying, and he knew that she was. The FBI had asked him to forward to them transcripts of the hearings in the Baird case, and so when he sent the transcript of this woman's testimony, he pointed out to them how obvious he thought her lies were. So the FBI paid her a visit, and they explained to her what the penalties were for perjury, and basically she saw the light very quickly that it was whatever money Jack Baird was paying her was not sufficient to get herself in really serious trouble. So she came clean to the FBI. They then wired her up and sent her to talk to Jack Baird at his off-duty job at a bar up in northeast Philadelphia. And she got him talking about their arrangement, which, of course, once the FBI had Baird on tape admitting that he was involved in this conspiracy to perjure, she then handed him a business card from one of the FBI agents, and he hit the roof. I mean, he knew that he had been caught.
But the story, the way you describe it, indicates that if the FBI hadn't intervened, that Baird probably would have gotten reinstated on the force,
well,
possibly
in fact,
with back pay.
In fact, the sergeant who was known to have lied to protect Baird and was identified as a liar in the police's internal affairs report and was subsequently fired, got his job back with full back pay after his appeal. And Baird lied for him at his arbitration hearing.
Now, there had been 22 previous complaints against Baird. He'd gotten off on all of them. You saw his evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
What were the evaluations like? What did they say about him?
Well, they were just extremely favorable. He was held in a very high regard. He was called an inspiration to the other men in the unit, an excellent officer, somebody who deserved more praise than they could give him. It was just the highest possible praise from his supervisors.
Was there any pattern in the 22 complaints against him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, going back 7 or 8 years before the incident with Arthur Colbert, there were a stream of people coming in saying he had racially insulted them, he had beaten them, he had stolen money from them, he'd held guns to their head. He had a history of telling exactly the same story to justify breaking into people's houses without a search warrant. There are certain mitigating circumstances that allow cops to do this. And he had a pat story that was so predictable that one of the public defenders in Philadelphia actually went and got the transcripts and was able to show that he had told verbatim the same story in dozens of different cases, which prompted a judge to order the DA's office to investigate Jack Baird. In other words, Jack Baird was notorious to virtually everyone who lived up in that police district, to the public defender's office, and was well known in the district attorney's office as being a rogue, dangerous cop. But within the police department, all he got were dismissed citizens' complaints and excellent ratings.
My guest is Mark Bowden, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He co-authored a 3-part series about one rogue cop in Philadelphia. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with reporter Mark Bowden. We're talking about the Philadelphia Inquirer series he co-authored on one rogue cop in Philadelphia. Now, you said that before you published your series that the mayor and the police commissioner in Philadelphia offered the Jack Baird case as an example of how good the Philadelphia police force was at policing itself.
Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten any response from the city or from the Philadelphia police to your 3-part series, which concluded today?
No, we haven't yet. We expect to solicit some response before the week is out, but the story just finished today. I think that's actually one of the things I'm going to try to do today.
Now, what do you think this story says about the ability of the Philadelphia police to police themselves?
Well, I think it's just clear that they don't police themselves with any success. And in fact, I think that certain kinds of officers like Jack Baird, because they're so aggressive out on the street, they make so many arrests. Jack Baird was one of the busiest officers in the 39th District. He and including these other officers who were indicted with him, were the most active, aggressive cops on the street. So I think that there is an incentive within the police department, which was very concerned about its arrest rates and the numbers that they can gather showing how many people they've put away for dealing drugs in these high drug districts. There's a real incentive to ignore the possibility that these guys are abusing citizens' rights, and they won't listen when people come in to complain. That, I think, and there's also this arbitration process makes it virtually impossible for the police department to consistently police itself.
The Internal Affairs Department of Philadelphia has investigated 575 allegations of police abuse in the previous 5 years, and I believe only two cases have resulted in disciplinary action.
That's right. Yeah, IAD has actually sustained something on the order of 10 of those 575, but then there's a process within the department before you get to the arbitration where you go to a review board, and a lot of times the review board will just overturn it. There's just an enormous bias within the department to protect police officers.
Now, what's the connection to this case that we've been discussing and the larger class action suit against the police in Philadelphia?
Well, after Arthur Colbert made his complaint and Jack Baird got caught by the FBI, he flipped and began talking to the FBI in order to get himself out of trouble, in order to mitigate what it promises to be a prison sentence, by offering to turn in other cops who were doing the same thing that he was. In fact, Baird has adopted this posture that he's being persecuted for actions and activities that are actually widespread throughout the police department. So he's been trying to make good on that claim by steering the FBI to officers now who are under investigation throughout North Philadelphia and in the police highway unit, which is the elite citywide patrol and investigative unit within the Philadelphia department. That has led, as I said, to a broadening investigation. And then each of these officers, Baird himself, accounted for well over 1,000 arrests over his 14 years on the police force. Every one of those arrests is now regarded with some degree of suspicion because he's admitted that he lied, that he framed people, that he obtained search warrants under false pretenses. So lawyers are lining up for all these people who have been sent to jail or convicted by a Jack Baird arrest. There have since been 5 other officers indicted, so multiply that number, it begins to grow exponentially. So right now, the city is looking at literally thousands of criminal convictions for which they can no longer tell what's the truth and what's the lie. And so in an instance like that, they have no choice but to overturn convictions against people because there's a presumption of innocence. Then each of these people is entitled to come back and sue the city for false imprisonment, false arrest, and the line is just beginning to form.
Probably this means that some guilty people might go free.
That's right. And that's the flip side of this. This isn't just a problem for civil libertarians to get upset about, because many of the people among the thousands that I've just mentioned are in fact guilty of crimes. Some of them have long criminal records. But when you have a criminal justice system where you can no longer tell a lie from the truth, you can no longer tell a good arrest from a bad arrest because you can't trust the testimony of your law enforcement officers, you have to let them all go. And so as a consequence, in my opinion, most of the people who are going to benefit by either being released from prison or having convictions thrown out or being awarded money are people who are guilty of crimes.
The Arthur Colbert, Jack Baird case, which you detail in your series on rogue cops, that happened under the watch of Willie Williams, who's
That's right.
since become the police commissioner in Los Angeles.
Yeah, there's an interesting link, you know, between these two cases. As I mentioned earlier, Colbert was, this happened to Arthur on February 24th of 1991, and he came in and filed his complaint on the 25th. 7 days later, Rodney King was beaten by 15 Los Angeles police officers, and that videotape, as I said, provoked this outcry against police abuse. The Attorney General ordered the FBI to begin looking at brutality cases all over the country. And at the same time, interestingly, Willie Williams was eyeing the top job in Los Angeles. He, in fact, had applied or would apply shortly for that job. And before the year was out, he was the Los Angeles police commissioner. So you had the FBI looking at Arthur Colbert's case, and you had a police commissioner who was suddenly highly sensitized to issues of police brutality. And I think that's why everyone in the 39th District certainly knew that Colbert's complaint was going to be handled a whole lot more aggressively and taken a lot more seriously than the previous 22 that had come through the door.
Is there a call for reform now within the Philadelphia police?
No. Actually, not a public one. I've heard from sources and policemen who I've interviewed in my work that, in fact, they are taking some steps to try to stop the sort of abuses that have gone on. When an officer like Barrett has 22 complaints filed against him over a 6 or 7 year period, you would think someone would begin to notice a pattern about this guy. And in each of these cases, if it boils down to the officer's word against the person who comes in and complains, the department is always going to believe the officer first. But when the 17th person comes through the door, it seems to me that the officer's word has to be held in a little bit of suspicion. So what they say they're going to do now is the captain from each district is going to be briefed on a regular basis by Internal Affairs about officers on his watch that have a problem, so that they can become more aware of it.
Do you know how morale is now in the Philadelphia Police Department?
Well, it seems really bad. I mean, I think everyone I talk to, they feel like they're under siege. A number of other incidents have happened in the last few weeks in Philadelphia. In addition to this federal probe, there was the head of the department's racial sensitivity unit or whatever was fired for making a racist joke to one of his colleagues at a rally that was overheard by people on the street. We recently had an officer who was caught involved in a sexual act with a little boy in the back of a police van in a part of Philadelphia. So that made huge headlines. So it's just one thing after another in the past month or so. And I think the department feels like it's under siege.
What's the reaction of the good cops?
Well, I think most of them are outraged about the behavior of people like Baird and others, and they're worried that the public will perceive all cops as being out of control. Most of them will say they're delighted when these guys get caught and when they lose their jobs. But in fact, history shows that in most instances, even good cops tolerate bad cops in their midst. If there's a code that you don't turn in, cops don't arrest cops.
What's happened to Arthur Colbert? He's the man who filed the charge against Jack Baird, the charge that ended Baird's career and started the FBI investigation of the Philadelphia police.
Well, Arthur did get his degree from college. He's back in Detroit, living in an apartment and working as a social worker. Ironically, he works as a drug abuse counselor for teenagers, the man who was accused of being a drug pusher here in Philadelphia. He's also an aspiring actor, and he's involved in an independent film production right now in Detroit. He sued the city after his arrest and settled for $25,000, which is a fraction of what his lawyers felt he could have gotten from the case. But Arthur told me that he was more interested in seeing these two cops punished, and when they were, for him, that was the end of it.
Mark Bowden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Mark Bowden is a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. He co-authored a three-part series on rogue cops. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Jim Gallipo, a probation officer who has spent the past 30 years working with gang members in South Central L.A. We'll ask him how the Furman tapes and police corruption scandals are affecting relations between cops and gangs. And we hear from the publisher of American Police Beat, a newspaper for cops. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. American Police Beat is a newspaper that describes itself as the voice of the nation's police officers. The publication is addressed to cops, and most of the articles are written by cops. The founder and editor, Cynthia Brown, is not a cop herself, but she used to work with cops as a volunteer for a pilot community policing project in Boston's South End. Earlier today, I asked her how her publication was covering police corruption stories, and she told me about their article on corruption in New Orleans.
The fellow that wrote the story did a lot of research on the economic problems of New Orleans, and this is something that the chief and his spokesperson said that as much as they tried to get the media to focus on really the things that have been going on there, the economic problems of New Orleans for the last 10 years, where you have enormous, with the oil industry collapsing in the late 80s, you had enormous dwindling of the tax base. You had a very kind of unusual affirmative action program forced on them where they literally had to just abandon their hiring standards. And, of course, they're among the lowest paid police in the country. For big city police, they start at $14,000 a year, and I think when they get out of the academy, they go up to $16,000. And, you know, we all know that police, more than any of the rest of us, really have an enormous opportunity to be corrupted out on the street because of the nature of what they do. And when they're so low paid and you don't keep your hiring standards up, it's just a recipe for trouble. And that's kind of what's happened there. So we actually went in and we explained what happened with the oil industry. And we talked about the fact that the French Quarter had lost 50% of its population. And we talked about the hiring standards. And we tried to just present a historical backdrop for this, because these things don't just happen, you know, without a reason.
What's the range of reaction you've heard about the Mark Furman tapes and the range of reaction that you've published?
Well, I'm just putting together that issue now. You know, they just have been out a couple of weeks. I'd say very pained. The LAPD, they're suffering enormously because of this. And I talked to a sergeant who was a supervisor of Mark, who basically said that they are in agony over it, and that he has devoted his life as a 27-year law enforcement person to helping the victims of crime, which are poor and minority people. And they're not wealthy, rich people that, you know, and to hear these tapes and have the whole department tainted with this kind of thing has just been very difficult.
Who is the anger directed at, Mark Furman or the media coverage of Furman?
Mark Furman. I think no one quite understands what he was doing, talking about the case, an ongoing case with his screenwriter. No one quite understands why he would describe going to calls and behaving in this manner when already several people that were on those calls have said this is like a complete fabrication. I think people are mystified. They don't quite get it. They don't understand, why was he talking to this woman for 10 years? Was he, you know, why was he talking about the ongoing Simpson case when he was the principal witness, you know, which is, I think people are mystified and angry, confused and angry about what it all means.
What have you been hearing about what it's like now to be a cop in the LAPD?
It's, well, you know, I just got, there's a national organization that every year gives out top cops awards. It's kind of like an Academy Awards evening for police, and they get people nominated from all over the country, and they decide on 10. And I was just reading yesterday these two police officers in L.A. that are going to be recipients this year, that literally the two of them walk through a wall of fire to rescue three people out of a two-car accident. It was a huge, the firefighters didn't even go through, and they were badly burned. It's the most unbelievable story. This happens, you know, this happened not that long ago. I think that what you do is you have these people, which is why I became so impressed with them, and they sit and they talk about the pressures of the job, and no one supports them, and the media's portraying them as, you know, brutal racists or whatever, and they're not going to do their job anymore. And then you see a call come in, and they just leap into that police car and they do their job. And, you know, I've seen this over and over. So I think there's a, it's very difficult. These Furman tapes are tough, but basically you have people that go out there and do what they're supposed to do, amazingly enough.
You've published a lot about stress and stress-related problems that the police face.
Right. We the issue before this one, we devoted a good portion of the issue to post-traumatic stress disorder, which a lot of these cops are walking around with and don't even know it. You know, for example, we had a murder. This is an extreme situation, but it just shows you how we had a murder in a suburb of Boston last week where a crazed guy from the John Hancock Insurance Company killed his wife and cut out several of her, like her heart and lungs and some other organs, and hung them on a clothesline. And all I could think of because of what I do all day is when I read that news story, I thought, what about the cops that had to go and take that stuff off the clothesline and put it all in the bag? Just this incident alone, which is extreme, of course, is enough to bring on post-traumatic stress disorder. But no one ever thinks of responding to car accidents, having to go to families and telling you know, telling families that their loved one is dead. All these very difficult things. So yeah, we do a lot of articles on stress, and I'm trying to keep the paper upbeat, so I don't like to do too much on that. But they are very interested in those kinds of things. And I got a call from the Phoenix Police Academy that they're using a lot of our stuff now in their training of their recruits, so they can, you know, be more aware of the psychological reactions when you've been through a trauma.
Cynthia Brown is the founder and editor of American Police Beat. Coming up, we talk with L.A. probation officer Jim Gallipo. This is Fresh Air. Earlier today, we called Jim Gallipo to get his impressions of how the Furman tapes and police corruption scandals are affecting relations between gang members and cops in South Central L.A., where relations were already tense. Gallipo started working as a probation officer in South Central 30 years ago during the Watts riots and has developed strong and lasting ties with many of the gang members he's worked with. Gallipo is also the vice president of the L.A. County Probation Officers Local 685. He's talked about his work with gangs twice before on Fresh Air. Gallipo told me the O.J. Simpson trial had no noticeable effect on relations between cops and gangs where he works until the Mark Furman tapes.
When the Mark Furman tapes came out, I mean, it just generated, you know, it just sort of drove a wedge again. I mean, I believe that LAPD has been making a concentrated effort, you know, in PR and community relations and everything since the Rodney King thing, and since, you know, Willie, you know, came from Philly.
Willie Williams, the police chief.
Right, you know, when he came out to really change, you know, things around. They spent a lot of money, a lot of man hours, you know, to change the image, change the police commissioners practically. Totally, and, you know, it was just depressing to see all this go down the drain behind one, you know, the rogue cop, I think, is a good name for him. But see, in South Central, they don't see him as a rogue cop. So, you know, this just sort of lent credence to the negative feelings of the people toward LAPD. And then, you know, in an effort to try to really bolster things up immediately, LAPD started, you know, in essence, you know, a cleanup campaign of their own. As they started investigating, they started finding more things. And now we've got some more officers that have been put off on suspension for falsifying police reports and allegedly falsifying police reports and this type of thing. And it's just, it's an atmosphere that scares me.
You know, what scares you about it?
It's scares me because, like, the day after the last barrage, which I suspect was probably last Tuesday, I think last Tuesday the news came out about these new officers, that particularly two officers who allegedly falsified reports. One of them was even a homicide investigation. And you know, now they're all of a sudden that the attorneys and the DA's office have to go through all the cases that these guys worked on for, you know, way back, you know, to maybe have retrials and maybe to have, mitigation of sentencing and maybe even, like I say, as far as retrials go. And to think about all this stuff and to think of what it's going to do to the already crowded, messed up court system in L.A. is really depressing. And I think about, you know, the officers that are out there in, you know, the thin blue line type thing where, I mean, they're down there in a combat zone, in combat gear, insulated from the community in terms of being in the police cars. And, you know, I'm afraid that it's gonna get to a point. What worried me the very next day, which was last Wednesday, I believe it was, there was a shootout at a Boys Market, which is one of our larger ghetto supermarket chains, and in a parking lot of the Boys Market, where a bad guy was killed, but two officers were shot and seriously wounded, and. You know, it just made me think with the kind of tactical deployment that they would do in a situation like that, if maybe these guys didn't wait a little too long, to shoot this type of thing. And, you know, these guys mostly are family men and all this type of thing, and they don't want to lose these jobs. And, I get the feeling that they feel that now anything that they're living in a glass house and anything they do, you know, they're going to be jumped on and presumed guilty until proven innocent, you know.
Do you think that the Mark Furman story is making it harder for good cops to do their job in Los Angeles?
Infinitely harder.
What are some of the pressures on them now?
Well, the pressures are that, I mean, part of the thing that all of us who are peace officers under what's called 832, a penal code section in the law that carry weapons are required to qualify periodically. Like, you know, with your off-duty weapon, you have to qualify every 3 months, quarterly. And, part of the training you get, it has to do with officer safety. And one of the things that has come up long ago is as far back as the Eula Love incident where a lady with a butcher knife was shot down by LAPD officers. Everybody thought how horrendous and awful it was for this poor, old lady, old black lady coming running out of her house at some armed, young, strong police officers. They couldn't wrestle with her or do something else. Well, maybe they could have. But the thing is, that they show you, in the scientific part of the training, that you have what you call a kill zone, is, as I recall, 15 feet. Now, that's a pretty long distance, 15 feet. But the way the nervous system works, if a person has decided to attack you, you know, they've made up their mind, they're going to attack you with a club, a knife, any type of a weapon, from that distance, they can charge you, a normal person, you don't have to be an O.J. Simpson or a track star, you know, they can get to you before you can draw your weapon and shoot them and stab you to death in a 15-foot radius. I mean, if they get inside that 15-foot radius, it's a crapshoot, whether they're going to get to you or whether you're going to be able to draw your weapon and shoot them in time. So, I mean, you know, normally, you know, you see in TV and everything that they're right up next to each other and all that type of thing. Well, they don't. I mean, there is a unwritten law that in law enforcement that your primary goal, the first thing that you have to do when you come on duty, is get home at night. You know, that's your primary responsibility, is to get home at night. And anything you have to do that, then you do. And, you know, there are incidents in South Central Los Angeles on a daily basis that require deadly force. And, you know, it's a situation where I would really hate to feel that this new series of officer-involved scandals is going to start making the young, you know, people who want to make it a career and who've already invested in houses and marriages and kids and cars and stuff think, well, look, I got to slow down. I can't shoot. You know, I mean, I can't afford to be thrown out on the streets with nothing but a high school education. And once you're fired from one police department, I mean, you're through.
Now, you work with young people. Most of the people you work with have been in gangs. Do any of the people you work with have any respect for the police?
Let me tell you, Terry, this is the mentality between the gangs, you know, like the real gang members and the police, and the real, I mean, the what we call the STRAC police units, the elite, the crash, which is called Concentrated Reaction Against Street Hoodlums. That's the acronym CRASH, is the gang unit of LAPD, and OSS for the Los Angeles County Sheriff, Operation Safe Streets. These are some of the best trained, youngest, you know, I mean, best physically fit, you know, win foot races, you know, and all this type of thing. These guys' mentality is so much like the gangbangers. I mean, they respect physical force. They respect physical prowess. They see you know, a certain honor in being tough and being macho and being you know, like not snitching and all this type of thing like that. And the mentality is strikingly similar. And once I, you know, one of the things I revel in doing is getting some of the tough cops together with the tough gang members and seeing how well they end up getting along. You know, and I've been able to do this in some notable situations. If my book ever gets published, I get a beautiful chapter in my book about that. And you know, that I have had more than one gang member, you know, say that they wish their life could be different, you know, because they'd like to be on the other side. They would like to be in that, you know, in that black and white. They'd like to be a crash officer working with gang members because they think they'd be good, and so do I. But once you've had felony convictions and all this stuff, I mean, it's over.
Do you ever try to convince the young people that you work with to have more respect for the cops?
Always. You know, and I have, you know, almost weekly, I'll have meetings with gang members where you know, they want to blast the police and talk about the pigs did this and this officer is particularly brutal and, you know, an asshole and everything else. Then I'll stop them and I'll sit them and I'll say, okay, good, man, you guys are all bad, you guys are all tough, and you guys could all handle the situation better. How many of you think we don't need cops in the ghetto? One out of 50 might say we don't. Then how many of you would like to do their job? How many of you guys would like to cruise around in a black and white through Nickerson Gardens and Jordan Downs and Imperial Court? These are Watts projects that are multi-story, where guys can get up on the roof and see these cars with their red and orange numbers coming in. And they can have assault weapons, and they can have hand grenades, and they can have firebombs and everything. And the police have no idea. And they have to ride around nightly through these areas waiting for the other shoe to drop.
So do you think that the young people you work with ever change their attitudes about cops?
Mm-hmm. And then again, one of the best things going is like I say, when I can get them together,
mm-hmm.
when I can get some of the really feared and active street police officers with, you know, the particularly feared and violent gang members, more often they get along than not. You know, I mean, when I can get them into an athletic deal, or I can get them into a boxing you know, ring or some things like that. I mean, it's just amazing to see what these guys do. Like I say, in one particular situation where I got a boxing thing going, a couple of crash officers got, you know, boxed with some really tough kids from the Rolling 60 Crips. This is, you know, many years ago. And during that time, you know, they don't make the long story short, you know, they came in and the cops wanted to wear body armor and all that stuff. And I said, no, you don't need body armor to go to a rec center, you know. And so they took off their body armor and we went in and they stared at the gang members and they stared back at them, nasty looks. And you know, at the end they were playing basketball and talking trash to each other. And one of the cops, without telling anybody, took these kids to a very expensive all-night fishing boat in Oxnard. I mean, he probably spent $200 on a couple of these kids, taking them to Oxnard on an overnight fishing boat and didn't tell anybody. There was a conversion. These kids just really loved him. And these were tough, probably had killed people type, you know, 17-year-old gang members. They would have never got a chance to go fishing on an all-night fishing boat without somebody like that. And he didn't tell anybody.
My guest is L.A. Probation Officer Jim Gallopo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with L.A. Probation Officer Jim Gallopo. For the past 30 years, he's worked with gangs in South Central L.A. We're talking about how the Furman tapes and police corruption scandals are affecting relations between gangs and cops. You've been a probation officer for, what, about 30 years?
Yep, 30 years.
You've worked with a lot of gang members. You've worked with a lot of cops.
Yep.
Do you think Mark Furman is at all typical of Los Angeles police?
No, I think he's a three-standard deviation person. Just like the gang member who can righteously come up on you and look in the face and beat you to death, and smell your sweat and feel your blood, and this is a one percenter. Mark Furman's a one percenter. They're three standard deviation people. But I think they're the same way that the police and in society in general views all gang members as dangerous, antisocial psychopaths. You know, the community, particularly the South Central L.A. community, views all LAPD, officers being more or less like Mark Furman. And it's a mistake. That's not true.
Have you ever been in a position where you knew that a cop had behaved in a racist way, had used epithets when speaking to somebody, or had, set them up, or stolen money, or whatever. Have you ever been with a cop when that's happened, or known that it's happened? And if so, what would your reaction be? Would it be to...
Well, you did a number, that was a whole lot of...
There's a long list.
Variables.
Yeah.
Basically, what I've been involved in has been brutality. You know, I've seen officers, when I've been out with them, use way more force than I felt was necessary for the situation. What have I done about it? Talk to them, you know. There are, you talk about, what do they say, the blue code or the code of silence or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I fall into that enough. Now, if I would have seen them, do something anywhere near as outrageous as the Rodney King thing or something like that, I would have felt it necessary to report it. And I would have reported it without hesitation. But I have seen hesitations where I've seen the situations where female officers have brutalized, and as a matter of fact, female black officers have brutalized female black, suspects, and as well as males, brutalizing, male blacks. But it's just that I understand where it's coming from.
So your approach is to talk to the
public. I try to talk to them.
And what would you tell them?
Well, basically, you're going to have to come back out here night after night after night. Now, when you do these things, persistently, continuously, habitually, they're going to be waiting for you. You're going to develop a reputation that's going to cost you. Someday, some of your car's going to break down. Someday, you're going to be off in a situation where you walk around into an alley without all the proper backup you need, and there's 30 of these people or something like that, you're much better off trying to have a communication. There is a time to use force. There is no question about it. You've got to be, they've got to be tough. They've got to be able to, show people they mean business, and that they're not to be played with or, fooled with and stuff like that. They need to have a certain... They need to be respected, and they need to be feared. And the problem is there's too much fear and too little respect.
Jim Gallipo is a probation officer who works with gangs in South Central L.A. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.